Faint studied the defenders opposite, watching as they regrouped, drawing reinforcements down from the higher earthworks.
"They're going to break cover," she muttered. "They're going to charge us."
Precious Thimble glanced over.
"What? Why would they do that?"
"Because most of us are headed east, down the valley. They can't let us chase after their own relieving force. They need to wipe out both the Lethary and the Balkando."
The witch's gaze was darting back and forth along the hasty defences thrown up by the Lethary.
"We're badly outnumbered."
"Haven't you been paying attention? Assaulting costs dear. We're about to turn the tables on them, and they're not going to like it."
"It's only the mixed bloods who are keeping them fighting at all," Precious said under her breath.
"What? What did you say?"
"It's the mixed bloods feeding off this cursed warren, using it to bend the Khaleesi to their will. I doubt they'd fight this hard without it."
"Now you say all this!"
Faint looked about, saw the prince sitting on a horse 20 paces away, his back to them as he observed the departing companies. Stepping forward, Faint stumbled slightly, recovered, but her head was spinning.
"What's wrong with me?"
"Blood loss,"
snapped Precious Thimble. Hissing in frustration, Faint made her way, slowly, towards Bryce Bedict.
"Find the damned mixed bloods. Aim a few onagers at them. Tear them to pieces, and this battle is done. Prince Bryce!"
The man turned his head. Faint hobbled forward.
"A word with you, Highness."
Ascending a valley side at the run and in full armour left the Perish staggering once they'd reached the top. Heart hammering in the cage of his chest, Sindacan pulled clear of the others and then halted, studying the lay of the land.
"Shit! It's all shit!"
40 paces away was a raised road running parallel with the valley, its steep side facing them banked with water-worn stones. In between was a strip of furrowed field left fallow for 2 years or more. Off to the right, 100 paces along, rose a cluster of buildings, farmstead facing onto the field, public stables and inn facing the road. Sindacan continued on, bleakly eyeing the sharp slope of the roadside. Reaching it, he sheathed his sword and scrambled his way to the top. Beyond the road, the unplanted fields stretched on for at least a third of a league, broken up by walled hedgerows forming a chaotic patchwork.
"Now that's better," he grunted.
No army would be happy crossing that. The walls alone would slow them up, since they were as high as a man was tall. The Perish could break up into half cohorts and contest one after another, and by the time the Khaleesi won through, the battle at the spire would be long over.
"Still leaves the road and this side, though. Narrow enough. But where do I wait my defence, road or field? And what about this infernal stony bank? Can't defend it worth a damn. That said, trying to breach along it would be a nightmare until they won through. So I throw a cohort 5 steps back of the line waiting for them. We bottle them up, don't let them spill out to the sides. It'll work. It'll have to."
Hands on his hips, he turned round, looked down on his grey helms. Winded, most of them bent over, or on one knee, gulping air like beached carp. He pointed at the buildings.
"Wounded, go there. Cutters on your way. Set up fast as you can. Rest of you, drink down the last of your water if you haven't already. Chew on some food while you're at it. We're going to hold on the road and this side of it, mostly. I want 2 cohorts on the other side in case they send anyone that way. If they do, make them pay, brothers and sisters. Now, march to 20 paces from the buildings and form up there."
Not a single groan as the Perish picked themselves up again and set off along the rippled, weed-knotted field. Swinging round, Sindacan looked up the road. Was that a glitter of pike points? He glared back at his grey helms.
"Step lively! Enemy sighted on the road! Wolves preserve us this day."
High-watered Festian gestured, watched as the columns plunged down off the road on the inland side, breaking up as they entered the hedgerow fields. He saw crews rushing ahead with picks to ensure that the passage gates through the walls were serviceable. 700 paces up the road he could see the cursed perish, but they had fully discounted the enclosed fields. Festian intended to lock fiercely with the grey helms, pushing forward with the weight of 15,000 Colansi heavy infantry, and then send 8,000 through the enclosures to take the road behind them. They would first crush the defenders on the road itself, and then drive the rest south across the field to the very edge of the valley, where the only retreat was a deadly tumble down the steep valley side. He intended to make quick work of this. In the distance to the east, he could make out the top third of the spire. Everything below that, on the ridge descent of the isthmus, was obscured in clouds of dust or smoke. The sight chilled him.
"And now Brother Diligence is dead, slain by some foul trap of sorcery. It all falls to you, Sister Reverence. But we shall prevail. Justice is a sword without equal. I pray to you, sister, hold on. We are coming."
Gilimada slowed her pace to match that of the war chief, and he glared up at the huge woman as he struggled for breath.
"I sent a scout up to the road. There are soldiers on it."
Spax nodded, but could manage little more. He couldn't remember the last time he'd led a raid, and while his warriors were thumping along in his wake with all the infernal ease of youth, his own legs were cramping. There was a stitch in his side, and sweat was stinging the vicious bite Abrastel's daughter had delivered to his penis the night before. That she'd been trying to tear it off with her own teeth was only because of her frustration and anger at getting pregnant. Nothing to do with him, really. And it was just his bad luck that his champion was the nearest thing at hand on which to vent all her anger and whatnot.
"We could attack," suggested the Teblor in her stentorian voice. "A surprise! Can we overtake 'em?" "Teblor can, but not you. They are using the road. There is a road up there. My scout saw it, and there were soldiers on it, running."
Did your scout see the perish?"
"No. Colansi soldiers on the road, running."
"Oh, my cursed gods of the Bargast, am I wallowing in the muck with you? Feels like it. With some brainless backwoods harridan for company, too. Felled any trees lately, woman?"
"What? No trees anywhere. I'd hit my head if there were trees. I'm glad there are no trees."
And she bellowed a laugh, only to then shake her head.
"Your language, it is so clumsy."
She drew a sudden deep breath, and out from her came a smooth flow of sounds Spax had not imagined possible from this Teblor.
"What was that?" he demanded when she'd finished.
"I make up poem songs in my own language. I am famous for it. Ha ha!
Care to translate what you just said?"
"No. Useless. You have one word for one thought. We have many thoughts for one word. You all speak too slow, and we have to slow down too, and we get bored talking to you humans."
Gasping, Spax shook his head.
"Right now, no more words from me at all."
"I should carry you?"
"Oh, and watch me try and live that down in front of all my warriors. They'd die laughing, never mind enemy pikes and swords." "Don't even touch me," he growled. "Ha, ha, ha!"
The Colansi wasted little time, pouring down from the road to form up opposite the parish on the field, and then, once the shields were locked and swords drawn, they advanced, matching step by step the troops remaining on the road. Sindacan stood one row back from the front line. Much as he wanted to be with his fellow cutters amongst the buildings, he was now commanding, and his place was here, with his brothers and sisters. They were still winded, their legs sagging under them. He knew the signs of muscle exhaustion, and there was no time to fully recover.
"This is going to be unpleasant."
The Colansi closed to within 6 paces, and then charged. Gilimada dropped back again.
"There is fighting!"
For God's sake, Tableau, we may be slow, but we're not deaf.
Should we join them from here?
Not unless you want to fight on the damned slope. No, we'll move past the whole mess and come up behind the parish, and then move forward.
But I want to kill the mixed blood.
Maybe you'll get a chance at that.
No, I want to kill him right away. It's important.
Fine, you can lead a counterattack once we're up there, all right?
Gilimada smiled broadly, her teeth even and white as snow.
And we will cut down every tree we see.
He glared at her back as she loped ahead. His heart felt ready to burst, and he wondered if it might, the moment he stepped up to fight, a sudden clenching in his chest or whatever happened when the thing seized up. He was certain that it had hurt, probably a lot. Glancing upslope to his left, he saw rising dust, and there, the flash of spears or perhaps pikes or even swords. Ahead, the Tableau raised a shout, and Spax squinted to see bodies sliding down the slope, limbs flailing, weapons skirling away.
Go past! Go past!
His warriors were pressing up behind him. Spax snarled.
Go round me then, damn you all! I'll catch up!
They poured past on either side in a clatter of armor and drawn weapons.
My beloved fools, all of you!
40 more heaving paces, another 10, 5, and then, looking up, he saw his Barghast scrambling in the wake of the Tableau, up the valley side, many of them using their hands where they could, and above them the parish falling back, spinning away from blows, tumbling and skidding down into the midst of the climbing warriors.
Gods curse us all! Climb! Get up there!
He saw the Tableau reach the summit, saw them plunge forward and out of sight, weapons swinging. And then, behind them, the first of the Gilk, armor grey with dust, their white faces running with stained sweat. Spax reached the base, clambered upward. His legs were half numb under him. Blisters roared with pain on his ankles, his heels. He coughed out dust, was almost knocked over by a descending corpse. A perish, most of his face cut away, and struggled yet higher.
Is there no end to this damned hillside?
And then a hand reached down, took hold of his wrist, and Spax was dragged onto level ground. They were in the midst of farm buildings, and the Colansi were on all sides, sweeping down from the road, driving the buckling clumps of perish back towards the valley edge. His first sight of this told him that the Grey Helms had been flanked, and though they fought on, with a ferocity worthy of their gods, they were dying by the score. His Gilk had slammed into this press, but even as they did so, more Colansi surged forward, fully encircling the defenders, with the valley side the only possible retreat. Dark fury raged in Spax as he staggered forward, readying his weapons.
We failed, Firehair. May all the swamp gods rot in Hood's own bog. We should have set out earlier. We should have marched with the parish.
The Tableau had formed a solid square and were pushing through the enemy, but even they were not enough. On the road, Spax could see massive elements of the Colansi army simply driving forward, eastward, ignoring the vicious last stand on their right.
We didn't even slow them down. Withdraw! Barghast, perish, Tableau, withdraw, down the hillside, back down the hillside!
Seeing warrior and soldier stumbling back, seeing them twist and pour down from the summit, the war chief's heart felt cold, buried in ashes.
Gessler, where your flank? We couldn't hold them, we just couldn't.
The press of retreating warriors, blooded and desperate, gathered him up, and they all slid ragged paths back down the slope. He was pulled along unresisting.
All this way, for this? We could have done more.
But he knew that any stand would have been doomed. There were just too many Colansi, and they fought with demonic valor. He had lost both his weapons on the descent, and his soul howled at the appropriateness of that. Tilting his head back, he stared up at the sun. It was barely noon. In the depths of night, rain was pouring down in Darujistan. Karsa Orlong had walked into the city, and now he stood, water streaming from him, waiting. Opposite him was the temple, and the vow that he had made so long ago now, in the savage intensity of youth, was a heat in his flesh, so fierce that he thought he could see steam rising from his limbs. Almost time. He'd seen no one else in the street since dusk, and during the day, while he had stood in place, the people of this city had swept past, unwilling to fix eyes upon him for very long. A troop of city guards had lingered for a time, nervous, half-circling his position where he had stood, his huge stone sword resting point down, his hands wrapped about its leather-bound grip. Then they had simply moved on. He would have been irritated at having to kill them, and no doubt there would have been alarms, and yet more guards, and more killing. But rather than being heaped with the dead, the cobbled width of the street before him remained unobstructed. Eyes half closed, he experienced again the echo of the life he had watched seething back and forth in the day now gone. He wondered at all those lives, the way few would meet the gazes of their fellows, as if crowds demanded willful anonymity, when the truth was they were all in it together, all these people facing much the same struggles, the same fears. And yet, it seemed, each one was determined to survive them alone, or with but a few kin and friends offering paltry allegiance. Perhaps they each believed themselves unique, like a knot stone in the center of the world's mill wheel. But the truth was, there were very few who could truly make claim to such a pivotal existence. After all, there was only one Karsa Orlong. Standing here across from a modest temple with stained walls and faded friezes, standing here with the fate of the world in his hands. He had known a time in chains. He had lived in that wretched house, his hands closed into fists against the slavery in which so many insisted he reside, meek, uncomplaining, accepting of his fate. He thought back to the citizens he'd seen here. So many had been dragging chains. So many had walked bowed and twisted by their weight. So many had, with their own hands, hammered tight the shackles, believing that this was how it was supposed to be. Sweating at another person's behest, the muscles and will given away and now owned by someone claiming to be their better in all things. Year after year, a lifetime of enslavement. This was the conversation of the civilized, and it repulsed Karsa Orlong to the very core of his being. Who was the slave master? Nothing but a host of cruel ideas, nothing but a deceitful argument, a sleight-of-hand deception between things of value, where one wins and the other always loses. He had heard bartering, had witnessed bargains made, and it all had the illusion of fairness, and it all played out as if it was a ritual deemed necessary, made iron like a natural law. But where was the joy in that ceaseless struggle? Where was the proper indolence of the predator? And just how many fangs needed pulling to make this precious civilization? Of course, not everyone suffered the same emasculation, and this was where all the lies finally gathered. The hungriest Moors, fangs dripping, hid in the cool upper rooms of the estates in the fountained gardens of the rich. And these ones, oh, they indulged all the indolence they desired, while the crowds of their lessers looked on, wide-eyed and ever eager for details. A broken and suffering god in chains had haunted him. It had flung weapons in his path. It had whispered all manner of enticements. It had, in all its desperate pain, rushed down 1,000 tracks, only to find not a moment of blessed relief. Karsa now understood that god. The times that he had been chained, he had felt that terrible panic, that animal frenzy to escape. No mortal, human or Toblakai, should ever feel such feelings. Nor, he knew now, should a god.
"He cannot know compassion from whom compassion has been taken. He cannot know love with love denied him. but he will know pain when pain is all that is given him.
Compassion, love. It was not civilization that birthed these gentle gifts, though its followers might claim otherwise. Nor was civilization the sweetest garden for such things to blossom in, though those trapped within it might imagine it so. No, as far as he could see, civilization was a madman's mechanism that, for all its good intentions, ended up ensnaring the gentle gifts, stifling them, leaving them to wander mazes only to die alone and in the dark. A mechanism, a cage work, and in its chaos the slaves bred like flies, until the world itself groaned under the assault of their appetites.
You have made many vows, Kasha Orlong.
A civilization was the means by which too many people could live together despite their mutual hatred. And those moments where love and community burgeoned forth, the cynics descended like vultures eager to feed, and the skies soured and the moment died away.
Upon my heart, Kasha Orlong, do you hear me? Upon my heart.
Blinking, Kasha looked down to see a crippled man drawn up against his feet. The rain streamed around him, gushed and swirled, and the face that had twisted up to look at him seemed to be shedding from blinded eyes the tears of the world.
Is it time, then?
Kasha demanded.
Will you kill it all?
The Toblakai showed his teeth.
If I can. It will simply grow up again, like a weed from the ashes. For all that we are made to kneel, Kasha Orlong, we yearn to fly. Yes, rare and noble and precious as pigeons. I've seen the statues of old heroes in the square, old man. I've seen their crowns of bird shit. I was an artist once. These hands, so deformed now, so bent and frozen. Can you understand? All this talent, but no way to release it, no way to give it shape. But perhaps we are all like that, and only the lucky few are able to find talent's path unbarred. I doubt it,
Kasha replied. Thunder rumbled from beyond the lake. The crippled man coughed.
I am drowning. I have enjoyed our conversation on the merits of the civilized, Kasha Orlong. But now I must surrender. I must die. Sick, fevered. The needs burn too hot. I have given you the words you shall use. Upon my heart. Upon my heart.
Kasha stared at the wretched shape at his feet. He set his sword to lean against the wall behind him, and then crouched down. The crippled man's face lifted, the sightless eyes white as polished coins.
What are you doing?
Kasha reached down, gathered the skeletal figure into his arms, and then settled back.
I stepped over corpses on the way here, the Toblakai said. People no one cared about, dying alone. In my barbaric village this would never happen. But here in this city, this civilized jewel, it happens all the time.
The ravaged face was turned upward, the last of the raindrops dripping away as he huddled beneath the cover Kasha provided. The mouth worked, but no sounds came forth.
What is your name? Kasha asked.
Moonug.
Moonug. This night, before I must rise and walk into the temple, I am a village, and you are here in my arms. You will not die uncared for.
You would do this for me, a stranger?
In my village, no one is a stranger, and this is what civilization has turned its back on. One day, Moonug, I will make a world of villages, and the age of cities will be over, and slavery will be dead, and there shall be no chains. Tell your god. Tonight I am his knight.
Moonug's shivering was fading. The old man smiled.
He knows.
It wasn't too much to take a frail figure into one's arms for those last moments of life. Better than a cot or even a bed in a room filled with loved ones. Better, too, than an empty street in the cold rain. To die in someone's arms, could there be anything more forgiving? Every savage barbarian in the world knew the truth of this. Behind their massive shields, the Vagath soldiers of the Kachin Chamal advanced into a hailstorm of arrows and heavy quarrels. Impacts staggered some of them, quarrels shattering against the shields. Others reeled, heads, necks, and chests sprouting shafts, and as they fell, their kin moved up to take their places, and the reptilian assault drew ever closer to the trenches and redoubts. In the center of the advance, the T'lani Maas weathered a similar deluge of missile fire. But they held no shields, and where the oversized quarrels struck, the bodies shattered, bones exploding into shards and splinters. Those that could then picked themselves back up and continued on. But many were too broken to rise again, lying amid the wreckage of their own bones. The withering fusillade lashed into the attacking forces again and again. Scores of Vagath went down, legs kicking, tails whipping or striking the ground. Deep gaps opened in the T'lani Maas lines. Yet there were no screams, no terrible cries of agony or horror. Sister Reverence stood high above the battle, winds both hot and bitter cold whipping about her, and watched as the enemy forces pushed ever closer to her soldiers waiting in their trenches and raised redoubts. The sorcery of Akrast Corvalane streaming from her, she held fast her Kalansi heavy infantry, leaving no room for fear, and she could feel them bristling as she fed them her hunger.
"Do not yield! Slay them all! Do not yield!"
They would hold. They had to. And then high-watered Festian would arrive to strike at the Kachin flank, driving deep a mortal wound against these hated enemies of old. She swore under her breath upon seeing masses of Kel hunters break out along the high rock-studded sides, rushing the fortified Onager positions, and she watched as the crews frantically swung the heavy weapons round. They managed a single salvo, the scores of quarrels tearing into the ranks of hunters, before the rest reached the base of the hill and swarmed upward, their terrible swords lifting high. As the helpless crews were slaughtered, their machines smashed into splinters, Sister Reverence dismissed the scene from her mind. She had seen 10 or more Kel hunters go down, and if each fortlet could match or better that toll, then she was satisfied. She would rely on attrition. There was no other choice. Now that the battle was underway, her panic had subsided. Though the murder of Brother Diligence still sent trembling waves of shock through her, she remained uncertain as to the manner of his death, and that still disturbed her. If she gave her dread free rein, she knew her fear would return. Humans were duplicitous and brazen. They should have known better than to underestimate their treacherous, deceitful natures. His power had been turned back upon him, somehow. He had drowned in a deluge of words, and she could not comprehend how that was even possible. But in this battle below, she could see but two humans.
"Riding Vagath by the Abyss. Do they command? No, that cannot be. The Kachin Chamal would never yield to human rule. They are ever commanded by their matron and none other. It has always been so, and so it remains. A formidable matron, however, to have spawned so many Vagaths. She stays hidden. She evades my questing. That alone speaks of impressive power. But when this is done, when her army is destroyed, I will find her. I will eviscerate her. This day is the last gasp of the Kachin Chamal. There are no other matrons left. I am certain of it. They must have discovered the alliance I made with the Naruk, and so they have come here seeking vengeance. Am I a child with a hand to be slapped? Of the four ancient races, who was always the most feared, if not the Fokrul Asael?
She knew there were other Pures on distant continents, and once Akrast Kol'Valain's power was made unassailable in this place, she would quest to find them. She would invite them to share in this power, and the cleansing could begin in earnest.
We shall unleash such justice as to...
A frigid blast of air swept up around her, and Sister Reverence turned from the battle below. Facing into that icy wind, she made her way across the platform to the side, looking out over the sea. What she saw stunned her. Kolant's Bay was filling with ice. Mountains, glowing emerald and sapphire, were rising up from the depths, and as she stared, she saw the churning water bleach white, saw every wave freeze solid. The perished ships, which had been broken and smashed and swallowed by the sea, had now reappeared, the wreckage sealed in ice. And there were more ships, ones long buried in the silts of the sea bottom, heaving to the surface. Directly below, the sheltered Kolansi galleys and triremes, now locked in ice, began to shatter, hulls collapsing. The sound of that destruction, rising up to where she stood, was a chorus of detonations, as of trees battered down by winds. The entire bay was now solid ice, the surface a crazed landscape of jagged translucent crags, welling fissures, and flat sweeps of dirty snow. Mists poured from it in roiling clouds. And, with the voice of grinding mountains, it had begun lifting higher, tilting, the nearest end reaching upwards. The mole and breakwaters of the harbour directly below were suddenly obliterated, torn and crushed to rubble. And as the ice shifted, reaching the base of the spire, Sister Reverence felt the stone tremble beneath her feet.
"This cannot be! Omtos Felak, what Jaghut dares this? No, they are gone, extinct. There is not one Jaghut left with this kind of power. We would have found the threat. We would have destroyed it."
Sister Reverence staggered back from the precipice as she felt the spire sway under her. Hearts pounding, hips aching, she stumbled across the platform. Reaching her previous position, she glared down at the battle, in time to see the Vagath soldiers pouring up the embankment.
"Rise, Kolansi! My blessed children, rise to meet them!"
Fists clenched, she flung her humans into the Kachane Chimal. Buffeted to one side by a collapsing Vagath, Gessler struggled for balance as his mount stumbled. He could see that the front line had plunged into the trench, and from higher up the tiers, hundreds of Kolansi were rushing down to support their besieged comrades. He saw Stormy, dragging his axe upward, a cloven helm jammed on the blade. The man's face was red as his beard, a berserk rage upon him. His Vagath stood atop the berm, its own weapons hammering down at the Kolansi swarming up to assail it.
"Fool's gonna get himself killed! He'll do it, too, just to spite me!"
He commanded his Vagath forward. Amidst the swirling flavors in his mind, he spoke to his Kachane Chimal.
"Take this trench! Push! All of you, push!"
Off to his right, he saw the Tlanimas chopping their way through the defenders, overrunning the redoubts. Once they were able to close in hand-to-hand fighting, their battle turned into slaughter. Gessler saw Onos Tulan, enemy weapons rebounding from him, wade forward, flint swords swinging. He seemed to be walking through a mist of blood.
"Bastards are showing us up. Of course, we're all flesh and blood, and they're not. Nothing's more irritating than an unfair advantage on the field. At least they're on our side. Gods, why am I even complaining? Push!"
The Vagath advance stalled in the trench. The sheer mass of armoured bodies had blocked the huge reptilian warriors. Their weapons tore through the Kolansi, but more of the enemy kept arriving. Ascending the berm, Gessler could see that the next tier of earthworks had been abandoned, all the forces pouring down to slam into the Kachane Chimal. Yet beyond those entrenchments, the remaining infantry stayed in their positions. He could see high redoubts on enfilading angles, onagers loaded and waiting.
This is going to take all day. Worse yet, we might even lose.
The Tlanimas had taken the trench at the center and were now seeking to broaden the breach. A salvo of heavy bolts slashed through their ranks.
Kill hunters! Sag Churok! We need you at the center! We need those onagers destroyed! The Tlanimas can break this wide open! Flow in behind them! The Gath rear ranks! Form up on the center and advance into the breach!
An arrow skidded off his left shoulder. Swearing, he kicked his Vagath forward, down into the trench to join Stormy. The slaughter was appalling, close and packed with heaving bodies, slashing and stabbing weapons. His Vagath landed on corpses, already the trench was at but half its normal depth, and the smeared limbs and torsos slipped beneath his mount's weight until its claws dug in for purchase. A half-dozen shield-locked Kalansi held the top of the ramp directly opposite, short-handled spiked axes at the ready. They were attacking the Vagath low, chopping at legs and thrusting at underbellies.
This is how the Malazans did it. Why couldn't these Kalansi be stupid?
Howling, he drove his Vagath forward.
We kill and we kill still more, and yet they do not break. Destriant, these soldiers are under a Gath. A pure-blood Fokral Asel commands their souls.
Kalith slowly nodded. She could see that well enough. No army could withstand this kind of ceaseless slaughter. She knew that thousands of Kalansi had fallen. The battle for the first trenches had consumed almost half the morning, and now, as the sun blazed directly overhead, in the very midst of the Jade Strangers, the Kachain Chemal and Tlanimas had advanced no further than crushing the last defenders of the third entrenchment.
Only halfway through the defences.
Beside her, the matron Gunth Mak spoke in a melange of flavours.
My Vagath are beginning to tire, Destriant. 1,000 have fallen and will not rise again. And now Gurul informs me that more Kalansi are on the way, upon the inland high road to the west.
Kalith hugged herself. What to do? What to say?
Then the Lethari and Balkando have failed.
No, they pursue, but they are much reduced and exhausted. They will not arrive in time to assist us. Destriant, it is difficult to reach the shield anvil and the mortal sword. They are in battle frenzy. Again and again they call upon a name I do not know, but each time it is voiced, something trembles in the air. A flavor pungent and bestial. Destriant, we must withdraw an element of our forces to meet this threat from the west. You must reach through to our human commanders. You must break their fury and speak with a voice of reason. Ride the minds of the Vagath. They will guide you to them.
Kalith drew a deep breath and then closed her eyes.
The tattoos on Gessler's forearms were burning, as if splashed with acid, but he barely noticed as he leaned over the shoulders of his reeling Vagath. He had never been so tired, so demoralized. The enemy would not break. The enemy fought with a rage to match his and Stormy's, and though they died and died, still more came. An axe spike had plunged deep into his mount's gut, and the animal was dying beneath him, yet somehow it remained on its feet. Somehow it continued advancing, weapons bashing foes aside. They had drawn closer to the center, to where the Tlanimas still pushed forward, their tireless arms rising and descending. Never before had Gessler been so close to the ancient undead warriors in the midst of battle, witness to this devastating implacability.
And the Emperor had almost 20,000 of them at his command. He could have conquered the world. He could have delivered such slaughter as to break every kingdom, every empire in his path. But he barely used them at all. Kellanved, is it possible? Did even you quail at the carnage these creatures promised? Did you see for yourself how victory could destroy you, destroy the entire Malazan Empire? Gods below, I think you did. You took command of the Tlanimas to keep them off the field of battle, to keep them out of human wars. And now I see why.
He still held his heavy sword, but had no strength left to even so much as lift it. The battle lust was fading. Something was assaulting it, tearing it down, away from his eyes, and all at once the redness of his vision fragmented, vanished, and he heard Caleth's voice.
Gessler, there is another Colensi army on the high inland road. They are fast marching. We must guard our flank.
Guard our flank? With what?
He angled his mount round, lurched as it staggered.
Ah, shit, my vergath's finished.
He pulled his boots from the scale stirrups, slid down from the beast's slathered back. Landing, his knees buckled and he fell to one side. Fighting to regain his breath, he stared up at the strange and strangely crowded sky.
All right, listen, Caleth. Draw the Kel back and send them over there, all of them. Tell Sag Churok I'm sending him the Tlani Mas.
He forced himself to his feet.
Did you hear all that?
He flinched as his vergath fell over, legs flailing, half its guts hanging out in thick ropes. He saw the life empty from its eyes.
Yes, Gorol says you must hurry. There is little time.
That damned Rizan's finally come back, has it?
Gorol says there is a storm coming, Gessler. He says you called it.
Like Hood I have.
He looked around, but Stormy was nowhere to be seen.
A storm? What's she going on about? Whatever it is, it's probably that red-bearded bastard's fault.
Cursing, the mortal sword set off to find Onos Tulan. His forearms, he saw with faint alarm, were sweating beads of blood. Onos Tulan cut diagonally in a downward chop through the torso of the Colensi opposite him, dragging his blade free as he stepped over the crumpling body. An axe head slammed into his ribs on his left side, bounced off, and he turned and slashed through his attacker's neck, watched the head roll off the shoulders. Two more strides and he was atop the fourth berm, his warriors coming up alongside him. Looking down into the trench, he stared at a mass of upturned faces, all twisted with inhuman hatred, and weapons lifted as he prepared to descend into the press.
First sword!
Onos Tulan paused, stepped back and turned round. The Malazan named Gessler was stumbling towards him.
Gessler, said Onos Tulan, there are but two more tiers left, and the number of enemy in those positions is sorely diminished. We shall prevail. Draw your vergath into our wake. First sword, we are about to be flanked to the west. I have sent what remains of my kill hunters there, but they are not enough.
Onos Tulan lowered his sword.
I understand. We will push on here without you, Gessler said. You've split the defenses in two, and when all is said and done, the vergath can outclimb and outrun humans. We will fight to the foot of the stairs. We will assault the spire. Akrust Corvalane is wounded now, mortal sword. Telan is awake. Olarethil is near. It seems that this shall be a day of ancient powers. Malazan, beware the voice of the pure who awaits you atop the spire.
The man revealed red-stained teeth.
Once I get up there, she won't have time to get a single damned word out. I wish you success, mortal sword. Tell the Kachin Chemal we are honored to have fought at their side this day.
Onos Tulan reached out to his followers, and as one they fell to dust. Sister Reverence could hear the grinding ascent of the ice against the spire off to her left, while before her she saw the Kachin Chemal carve their way ever closer to the base of the stairs. The Tlani Mas had vanished, but she knew where they were going.
And high-watered Festian will have to face them. He will have to find a way to encircle them, to win past and strike the Kachin Chemal.
Then she looked skyward, where enormous dark clouds were building almost directly overhead, forming huge, towering columns bruised blue and green. She saw flashes of lightning flaring from their depths, and the blinding light was slow to fade. Two remained, burning luridly, and instead of diminishing, it seemed that those actinic glares were growing stronger, deepening in hue. All at once, she realized what she was seeing.
There is a god among us. A god has been summoned.
The eyes blazed with demonic fire, and the clouds, ever massing, found form, a shape so vast, so overwhelming, that Sister Reverence cried out. The argent gleam of tusks, the clouds curling into swirls of dark fur, towering, seething, building into a thing of muscle and terrible rage, the eyes baleful as twin desert suns, dominating the entire sky above the spire, Fenrir, the boar of summer, manifested.
This is no sending. He is here. The god Fenrir is here.
With dawn paling the grey sky overhead and water running in streams along the gutters, Carsa Orlong looked down at the peaceful face of the old man cradled in his lap. He slipped a hand under that head and lifted it slightly, and then moved away, settling it once more on the hard cobbles of the street. It was time. He rose, taking hold of his sword. Fixing his eyes on the temple opposite, he walked towards the barred door. The city was awakening. Early risers out on the street paused upon seeing him crossing their path, and those who could see his face backed away. He reached for the heavy brass latch, grasped hold of it, and tore it away from the wooden door. Then he kicked, shattering the door's planks like kindling, the sound of the impact like thunder, its echoes tumbling down the passageway within. Voices shouted. Carsa entered the temple of Fenrir. Down a once opulent corridor, past the flanking braziers, two priests appearing with the intent of blocking his passage, but when they saw him, they shrank from his path. Into the altar chamber, thick smoke sweetly redolent with incense, a heat rising from the very stones underfoot, and to either side the paint of the murals was crackling, bubbling, and then it began to blacken, curling away from the walls, devouring the images. Priests were wailing in terror and grief, but the Toblachai ignored them all. His eyes were on the altar, a block of rough-hewn stone on which rested a jewel-studded boar tusk. Closing on the altar, Carsa raised his stone sword.
Upon his heart.
When the blade descended, it smashed through the tusk and then continued on, cracking the altar stone with the sound of thunder, shattering the block in half. Onos Tulan could hear weeping, but this was the sound of something unseen, something long hidden in the souls of the Tulani Mas. He had never expected it to awaken, had never expected to feel it again. In his mind, he saw a child, clothed in mortal flesh, lifting a face to the heavens, and that face was his own, so long ago now. There had been dreams, but even as they faded, the child boy wept with shuddering convulsions.
Things die. Dreams fall to dust. Innocence bleeds out to soak the ground. Love settles in cold ashes. We had so much, but we surrendered it all. It was unforgivable.
He rose again on a broad, level stretch of land where a village had once stood. It had been made mostly of wood, and that wood had been taken away to build engines of war. Now only the foundation stones remained. The raised road that ran into it sloped until it was level with the cobbled street at the village's edge. His kin rose around him, and they moved out to present a broad front facing onto that road, there to await the army they could now see to the west. The sound of thousands of marching boots on cobbles was a solid roar underfoot.
We shall fight here, because the fighting and the killing goes on forever, and the child will shed his tears until the end of time. I remember so many loves, so many things lost. I remember being broken again and again. There need be no end to it. There is no law to say that one cannot break one more time.
When he raised his weapon, his kin followed suit.
7,459 Tlanimas. Another battle. The same war. The war we never lost, yet never knew how to win. The concussion that clove through the heaving clouds behind them staggered the Tlanimas, a thunder so loud it shivered through their bones. Wheeling round, Onos Tulan stared up to see a stone sword, an Imas sword, descending as if held in the hand of the jade strangers, impossibly huge, slicing down through a vague bestial shape, that then staggered. Twin embers of crimson, eyes, suddenly blossomed as if filling with blood. A roar sounded, filling the air with such fury and pain that it pounded the entire army of Tlanimas back a step, and then another.
The death cry of a god.
And the heavens erupted. Onos Tulan watched the waves of blood descending, falling earthward. He watched the crimson sheets rolling across the land, watched them roll ever closer, and then with yet another roar, the rain slammed down upon the Tlanimas, driving them to their knees. Head bowed beneath the deluge, Onos Tulan gasped, one breath, another, and his eyes, fixed now upon the hands on his knees, slowly widened. As the withered skin softened, thickened, as muscles expanded. Another terrible gasp of breath, deep into aching lungs. From his kin, sudden cries, of shock, of wonder.
We are remade. By the blood of a slain god, we are reborn.
Then he lifted his gaze to look upon the Kalansi ranks, fast closing on their position.
This was ill-timed.
The blood of a slain god rained from the sky, in torrents cascading down from the ruptured, now shapeless clouds. The air filled with the terrible roar of those thick drops, falling heavy as molten lead. The armies fighting near the highest level of the isthmus were staggered by the downpour. The vast shelf of ice, ever rising towards the pinnacle of the spire, now streamed crimson in growing torrents. Bowed beneath the onslaught, Sister Reverence staggered towards the altar stone. Through the carmine haze she could see the crippled god's heart, no longer a withered, knotted thing of stone, now pulsing, now surging with life. But the sorcerous chains still held it bound to the altar.
This changes nothing. My soldiers shall hold. I still have their souls in my hands. I have the chains of their fallen comrades, their slain souls, all feeding my power. At the foot of the stairs they shall make a human wall, and I will take this unexpected power and make of it a gift. I will feed this blood into the soul of Akrast Korvalain.
She drew up against the altar stone, slowly straightened, and held her face to the sky, to feel that hot blood streaming down. And then, laughing, she opened her mouth.
Make me young again. Banish this bent body. Make all that is outside as beautiful as that which was ever inside. Make me whole and make me perfect. The blood of a god. See me drink deep.
It was as if the heavens had been struck a mortal wound. Kallus cried out in shock, in dread horror, as the deluge descended upon the land, to all sides, devouring every vista as if swallowing up the entire world. The blood on her face, on her hands, felt like fire but did not burn. She saw the heavy drops pounding into the lifeless earth, saw the soil blacken, watched as streams of thick mud slumped down the hillsides. She could barely draw breath.
Gansmak, what will come of this?
Destriant, I cannot give answer. Immortal rituals unravel. Ancient power melts, dissolves. But what do these things mean? What is resolved? No one can say. A god has died, Destriant, and that death tastes bitter, and it fills me with sorrow.
Kallith saw how the Kachain Jemal, momentarily stunned, now resumed their assault upon the highest defences of the Kalansi. She saw the defenders rise to meet the Vagas.
A god dies, and the fighting simply goes on, and we add to the rain with blood of our own. I am seeing the history of the world here before me. I am seeing it all, age upon age, all so useless.
There was low laughter behind her, cutting through the dull roar, and Kallith turned. Sin had stripped naked, and now she was painted in blood.
The pure has made a shining fist, she said, to block the ascent. The lizards cannot break it. Their oils are fouled with exhaustion.
Her eyes lifted to Kallith.
Tell them to disengage. Order them to retreat.
She walked past. The Imas reeled back. The Kalansi heavy infantry pushed forward over Imas corpses. With shields and armor, they weathered blows from stone weapons. With iron sword, axe, and spear, they tore apart unprotected flesh, and on all sides the rain of blood, cooled now, lifeless, hammered down. Driven past the remains of the village, the Imas forces contracted, unable to hold the enemy back. Pincers swept out to either side, seeking to encircle the increasingly crowded, disorganized warriors. Onos Tulan sought to hold the center in the front line. He alone remembered what it was to defend his own body, now so vulnerable, so frail. His kin had forgotten. They attacked unmindful of protecting themselves, and so they died. Reborn, only to live but moments. The anguish of this threatened to tear the First Sword apart. But he was only one man, as mortal as his brothers and sisters now, and it was only a matter of time before. He saw the Kalansi line opposite him flinch back suddenly, saw them hesitate, and Onos Tulan did not understand. Low, deep laughter sounded from somewhere on his right, and even as he turned, a voice spoke.
Imas, we greet you.
Now, pushing through to stand in the foremost line,
Jagat.
Armored, helmed, bristling with weapons, all of it dripping blood. The Jaghut beside Onos Tulan then said in a loud voice,
Suvalas, are you as beautiful as I remembered?
A female shouted in answer,
You only remember what I told you, Hort, and it was all lies.
Amid Jaghut laughter, the one named Hort tilted his head to regard Onos Tulan.
To draw breath was unexpected. We thought to fight with you, two lifeless but eternally stubborn peoples. A day of slaughter! Ha!
The Jaghut beyond Hort then said,
And slaughter it shall be. Alas, the wrong way round. And there are but 14 of us. Imanan, you are good with numbers. Does 14 dead Jaghut constitute a slaughter?
With 5,000 Imas, I would think so, Ghedoran.
Then our disappointment is averted, and I am once more at ease.
The Jaghut drew weapons. Beside Onos Tulan, Hort said,
Join us, First Sword. If we must die, must it be on the back step? I think not.
His eyes flashed from the shadows of his helm.
First Sword, do you see? Fokrul Asel, Kachain Jemal, Imas, and now Jaghut. What a fell party this is!
Ghedoran grunted and said,
All we now need are a few Thel Akai, Hort, and we can swap old lies all night long.
And then, with bull roars, the Jaghut charged the Kalansi. Onos Tulan leapt forward to join them, and behind him, the Imas followed. Gilimada, who had been chosen to lead because she was the most beautiful, looked back on the way they'd come. She could barely make out the Barghast.
They are slow. "If only you were taller, Gilly,"
bellowed her brother, Gand.
"You could look the other way and see the fighting."
Scowling, Gilly Marda faced forward again.
"I was about to, impatient runt, Gand. Everyone, enough resting. We shall run some more. Do you all see?"
"Of course we do,"
shouted one of her brother's mouthy friends.
"We're all taller than you, Gilly."
"But who's the most beautiful?"
"Exactly." "Gilly, there are Jaghut with those imas."
Gilly Marda squinted, but the truth of it was, she was the shortest one here.
"Are they killing each other?"
"No."
"Good. All the old stories are lies."
"Surely just that one, Gilly."
"No. If one is a lie, then all of them are. I have spoken. Is everyone rested? Good. Let us join the fight, just like in the old story about the war against death itself."
"But it's a lie, Gilly. You just said so."
"Well, maybe I was the one doing the lying. Did you think of that? Now, no more wasting of breath. Let us run and fight."
"Gilly, I think it's raining blood over there."
"I don't care. You all have to do what I say, because I'm still the most beautiful, aren't I?"
With the remaining Kell hunters cut and slashed, many with the snapped stubs of arrow shafts protruding from their bodies, Sag-Churok advanced at a cantering pace. Before them, he could see the Imas, granted the bitter gift of mortality, locked in fierce battle against overwhelming numbers of Kolansi heavy infantry. Among them, near the front, there were armored Jaghut. To see these two ancient foes now standing side by side sent strange flavors surging through the Kell hunter, scouring away his exhaustion. He felt the sense flowing out now to embrace his kin, felt a reawakening of their strength.
"What is this that so stirs my heart? It is glory. We rush to our deaths. We rush to fight beside ancient foes. We rush like the past itself into the face of the present. And what is at stake? Why, nothing but the future itself. Beloved kin, if this day must rain blood, let us add to it. If this day must know death, let us take its throat in our jaws. We are alive, and there is no greater power in all the world. Brothers, raise your swords!"
Reaching level ground, the Kachain Chemal Kell hunters stretched out their bodies, swords lifting high, and charged. 278 Teblor smashed into the flank of the Kolansi forces near the line of engagement. Suddenly singing ancient songs, mostly about unexpected trysts and unwelcome births, they thundered into the press, weapons swinging. Kolansi bodies spun through the air. Entire ranks were driven to the ground, trampled underfoot. Wild, terrible laughter rose from the Jaghut upon seeing their arrival. Each of the 14 led knots of Imas, and the Jaghut themselves were islands amidst slaughter. None could stand before them. Yet they were but 14, and the Imas fighting close to them continued to fall, no matter how savagely they fought. The Kell hunters struck the inside envelopment, driving the enemy back in a maelstrom of savagery. They swarmed out across the pasture and over the paddocks to swing round and plunge into the Kolansi flank, almost opposite the Teblor. And in answer to all of this, high-watered Festian ordered his reserves into the battle. 4 legions, almost 8,000 heavy infantry, heaved forward to close on the enemy. Bitter Spring, crippled by a sword thrust through her left thigh, lay among the heaps of fallen kin. There had been a charge, it had swept over her, but now she saw how it had stalled, and was once more yielding ground, step by step. There were no memories to match this moment, this time so short, so sweet, when she had tasted breath once again,
when she had felt the softness of her skin, had known the feel of tears in her own eyes, how that blurred her vision, a thing she had forgotten. If this was how living had been, if this was the reality of mortality, she could not imagine that anyone, no matter how despairing, would ever willingly surrender it.
And yet?
The blood still raining down, thinner now, cooler on her skin, offered no further gifts. She could feel her own blood, much warmer, pooling under her thigh and around her hip, and the life so fresh, so new, was slowly draining away. Was this better than an inexorable advance into the enemy forces? Better than killing hundreds and then thousands when they could do little to defend themselves against her and her immortal kind? Was this not, in fact, a redressing of the balance? She would not grieve, no matter how short-lived this gift.
I have known it again, and so few are that fortunate. So few.
The ship of death lay trapped on its side, embraced in ice. Captain Shurk Elal picked herself up, brushing the snow from her clothes. Beside her, Skorgan Kaban, the pretty, was still on his knees, gathering up a handful of icy snow and then sucking on it.
"Bad for your teeth, pretty," Shurk Elal said.
When the man grinned up at her, she sighed.
"Apologies, forgot you had so few left."
Princess Falash came round from the other side of the ship's prow, trailed by her handmaid.
"I have found him," she announced through a gust of smoke. "He is indeed walking this chilly road, and it is safe to surmise, from careful gauging of the direction of his tracks, that he intends to walk all the way to that spire, into that most unnatural rain."
Shurk Elal squinted across what had been, only a short time ago, a bay. The awakening of Omtos Felak had been like a fist to the side of the head, and only the captain had remained conscious through the unleashing of power that followed. She alone had witnessed the freezing of the seas, even as she struggled to ensure that none of her crew or guests slid over the side as the ship ran aground and started tilting hard to port. And alone among them all, she had seen Hood setting out on foot. A short time later, a storm had broken over the spire, releasing a torrential downpour of rain that seemed to glisten red as blood as it fell over the headland. Shurk Elal regarded Falash.
"Princess, any sense of the fate of your mother?"
"Too much confusion, alas, in the ether. It seems," she added, pausing to draw on her pipe and turning to face inland, "that we too shall have to trek across this wretched ice field, and hope that it does not begin breaking up too soon, now that Omtos Felak sleeps once more."
Skorgan scowled.
"Excuse me, sleeps? Captain, she's saying it's going to melt?"
"Pretty," said Shurk Elal, "it is already. Very well, then, shall we make haste?"
But the princess lifted a plump hand.
"At first I considered following in Hood's footsteps, but that appears to entail a steep and no doubt treacherous ascent. Therefore, might I suggest an alternative, that we strike due west from here?"
"I don't know," said Shurk Elal. "Shall we spend half a day discussing this?" Falash frowned.
"And what precisely did I say to invite such sarcasm? Captain?"
"My apologies, Highness. This has been a rather fraught journey."
"It is hardly done, my dear, and we can scarcely afford the luxury of complaining now, can we?"
Shurk Elal turned to Skorgan.
"Get everything ready. There truly is no time to waste."
The first mate turned away and then glanced back at Shurk.
"If that's the case, then why in Mael's name is she—"
"That will be enough, pretty."
"Aye, Captain. Sorry, Captain. On my way, aye."
"Queen Abrastel, I will deliver your daughter into your keeping. With every blessing I can muster, take her, I beg you, before I close my hands round that soft, delicious neck and squeeze until her brains spurt from every hole in her head. And then her handmaid will have to chop me into tiny pieces, and Skorgan will do something stupid and get his head sliced in half, and won't that be a scar worth bragging about?"
She could just make out Hood's trail towards the spire, and caught herself looking at it longingly. Don't be a fool, woman. Some destinies are better just hearing about over ales in a tavern. Go well on your way, Hood, and the next face you see, well, why not just bite it off? He had passed through the gates of death, and this rain, in its brief moments of magic, could do nothing for ghosts. No kiss of rebirth, and no blinding veil to spare from me what I now see. Tok sat on his lifeless horse, and from a hillside long vanished, worn down to nothing but a gentle mound by centuries of ploughing. He watched, in horror, the murder of his most cherished dreams.
It was not supposed to happen this way. We could smell the blood, yes, we knew it was coming. But Onos Tulan, none of this was your war. None of this battle belonged to you.
He could see his old friend there at the center of less than 1,000 imas. The 14 Jaghut had been separated from kin and now fought in isolation, and archers had come forward, and those Jaghut warriors were studded with arrows, yet still they fought on. The Kel hunters had been driven back, pushed away from the imas, and Tok could see the Toblakai, barely 50 of them left, forced back to the very edge of the slope. There were Barghast on that far side now, but they were few and had arrived staggering, half dead with exhaustion. Tok found that he was holding his scimitar in his hand.
But my power is gone. I gave the last of it away. What holds me here, if not some curse that I be made to witness my failure? Onos Tulan, friend. Brother, I will not await you at the gates. My shame is too great.
He drew up his reins.
I will not see you die. I am sorry. I am a coward. But I will not see you die.
It was time to leave. He swung his mount round and stopped. On the high ridge before him was an army mounted on lifeless war horses.
Bridge burners.
Seeing Whiskey Jack at the center, Tok kicked his mount into a canter, and the beast tackled the hillside, hoofs carving the broken ground.
Will you just watch this?
He cried as his horse scrabbled up onto the ridge. He drove his charger towards Whiskey Jack, reined in at the last moment. The old soldier's empty eyes were seemingly fixed on the scene below, as if he had not heard Tok's words.
I beg you,
pleaded Tok, frantic, the anguish and frustration moments from tearing him apart.
I know I am not a bridge burner. I know that. But as a fellow Malazan, please, Whiskey Jack, don't let him die.
The lifeless face swung round. The empty eyes regarded him. Tok could feel himself collapsing inside. He opened his mouth to speak one more time, to plead with all he had left. Whiskey Jack spoke in a tone of faint surprise.
Tok younger, did you truly imagine that we would say no?
And he raised one gauntleted hand, the two soldiers of his own squad drawing up around him, Mallet on his left, Trots on his right. When he threw that hand forward, the massed army of bridge burners surged onto the hillside, lunged like an avalanche, sweeping past Tok, driving his own horse round, shoving it forward. And one last time, the bridge burners advanced to do battle.